Welcome to episode number 5 of Tech Talk Today on WCCR 94.5 LP FM, live from the beautiful campus of University of the Cumberland in Williamsburg, Kentucky. Triple T provides you with the latest news in the tech world and our opinions of what it all means. I'm Justin Hensley.
And I'm Kurt Lawson. Let's get Triple T started with this week's news. When I saw this one, I just love this one. Hackers ransom European Domino's customer data, and it includes favorite toppings. It was on Slashdot. Hackers who compromised the servers of Domino's Pizza have demanded a ransom of £30,000, or they will publish the records of more than 600,000 customers, including their favorite toppings. Earlier this week, we hacked our way into the servers of Domino's Pizza, France, and Belgium, who happen to share the same vulnerable database, wrote Rex Mundy. May not be pronouncing that right. The name perpetrators go by. And boy, did we find some juicy stuff in there. That seems to be a new thing, is ransom hacking.
So they want 30,000 pounds of pizza?
That's good. That's good.
30,000 pounds of British money. I guess, right?
right.
Okay. Good deal.
All right.
So, okay, in a Network World article, now that I'm done being funny, researchers at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology have developed a 36-core processor.
Ooh.
In an effort to find new ways to eke more performance out of chips. Now, processors, you talk about, if you go to buy a computer, you see quad-core processor, dual-core processor. Okay, so that's 2 or 4 cores. We're talking 36-core processor. So what they've been able to do in the last decade is put – used to have a processor, and that was just one processor. But now they're able to put more processors on one chip, and it's called a core. And so you may go out to the store and buy a quad-core processor. Well, these people made 36-core processors. This chip is designed, according to the article, to reduce the number of cycles required to execute tasks by enabling data transfers between cores and cache more in a more coherent manner, says this gentleman who is a PhD candidate in MIT's Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. With the help of many routers, MIT has devised a novel way to reroute data packets to free up bandwidth within multi-core chips. The research could benefit highly parallel applications such as financial analytics and particle simulation studies.
Ooh, sounds pretty good. Let's see here. The FBI, they have a jargon list with the internet acronyms that we all use. So do you use a lot of acronyms? I know I've answered texts with LOL a lot, sometimes just pronouncing LOL. But AYOR, at your own risk, because the FBI knows exactly what you're saying, thanks to the agency's insane list of Twitter shorthand, rather than just rely on Urban Dictionary or Google search, the agency has compiled an 83-page list of more than 2,800 acronyms. The FBI responded to a request with one of the most illegible scans of a document you'll ever see embedded on a CD. So maybe the agency isn't all that up on its technology, or maybe it's just doing its best to KTAS, or keep this a secret. Oh, I thought that was pretty funny. Of course, I use them all the time. I don't know about you, any kind of acronym, but to have an entire list on a CD, I guess they give it to their employees. I don't know.
OMG TGIF. That's what I was supposed to say, right?
NTY, now to you.
Another Network World article. Yahoo has released an Android personalization app that could give the company stronger foothold in mobile contextual search. Yahoo's Aviate is the company, is the product of the company's acquisition, Aviate, earlier this year, through which it obtained an app for personalizing the home screen of Android phones based on what users are doing. Now, Aviate's app had been in a closed beta, which means that they only were allowing certain people to beta test it. The version launched Monday is available globally for Android phones in English with some new features. So if you are an Android user and you've used this product in the past, you may want to take a look at that new acquisition from Yahoo.
Interesting. Let's see here. Wikipedia. So I found out recently that Wikipedia, well, different companies will pay people to write articles or to change articles for that particular company. Or I guess they could do it against their competitors. But looks like somebody wrote on Slashdot that Wikipedia Foundation is updating its terms of use to keep track of editors who are paid for the changes that they make. This follows last fall's discovery that a small industry had arisen around public relations firms running Wikipedia editing campaigns for paying clients. The foundation now says if you are paid to edit, you will need to disclose your paid editing to comply with the new terms of use. You need to add your affiliation with your edit summary, user page, and talk page to fairly disclose your perspective. Specific policies on individual Wikimedia projects or relevant laws in your country, such as those prohibiting fraudulent advertising, may require further disclosure or prohibit paid advocacy editing altogether. And basically, they're saying that this threatens the trust of Wikimedia's volunteers and readers. So I thought that's pretty interesting.
I mean, the question is how useful is it anyway? I mean, is the information really good? I mean, I go to Wikipedia to look stuff up, but I just wonder when it's going to get to the point when I go there, I know that what I'm reading is actually true.
Oh, right. This is not peer reviewed, right?
Exactly. But it is, you know, if somebody's getting paid to do something, I guess that's good to know. In a BGR article about the Microsoft Surface 3, Microsoft is very, very confident that the Surface Pro 3 really can replace your laptop. In fact, they're so confident that they're willing to lay some significant money down to get you to swap in your MacBook Air for Surface Pro 3 between now and July 1st. I don't know if anybody else out there just passed out by that from that suggestion, but ZDNet reports that you can get an in-store credit worth up to $650 towards buying a Surface Pro 3 if you trade in a working MacBook Air model that doesn't have any water damage or a cracked display. Now, keep in mind, you probably paid well over $1,000 for that. The cheapest Surface Pro 3 with a keyboard you can get right now costs $929. So trading in your MacBook Air and getting a full $650 in-store credit will knock that price all the way down to a whopping little $279. In all, if you have an old MacBook Air that you don't use much anymore and you're curious about the Surface Pro 3, it seems like a pretty sweet deal to take advantage of, says the writer of this article. Personal opinion, okay. Surface is just like another tool in your toolbox. Right. I mean, this is the way I think about technology anyway. I mean, my iPhone is a tool in my toolbox. My MacBook Pro that I have sitting here in front of me is a tool in my toolbox. My Surface that I have is a tool in my toolbox. All these things are tools in the big toolbox, but you don't particularly use one for everything.
Right.
I mean, when I have to go tighten up a screw on something on my truck, I don't go get my hammer. So, I don't know. I don't see that they're one and the same. I mean, you know, can I run an Adobe suite of, you know, picture and video products on my Surface? Probably not very well. You know, is my Surface small and mobile like a MacBook Air? Probably not. So I don't know. I don't get it. I mean, I guess if you're wanting to switch, have fun, but I don't know what your thoughts, Kurt. Maybe I'm just weird.
Well, one question I get from a lot of people that I help out in my personal life especially is people will say, Kurt, what browser should I use? Or should I switch to this? And, you know, if I look at my computer, I have at least three browsers installed on my computer at any time. I don't use one specifically just for everything. So, you know, when people say, like, I need a new computer. What would you suggest? We're like, well, what are you going to do with it? You know, there's different things that fit different suggestions, I guess. And this is just them probably trying to find the marketing penetration to say this is what you need for almost everything. Because, you know, most people don't know what they need, to be completely honest.
I'm not sure that Microsoft, as far as the Surface is concerned, knows anything about marketing. I mean, for instance, up at the mall in Lexington, they talked about this new store we're going to put in. It's a kiosk.
Oh, right.
I mean, it's not a store. That's a kiosk. Anyway, I'm done. Sorry.
Oh, well, you definitely can't fight Apple's marketing. That's one thing for sure.
Yeah. You can try.
I mean, they got people brainwashed. I shouldn't say that. All right. Google. This one I thought was very cool. Well, not cool. Bad for indie people. But Google says indie musicians must join streaming service or be removed. Apparently, what a lot of indie groups are doing is, and indie basically just means, you know, they're unsigned, you know, underground, I guess. They're in a statement to the Financial Times and reported by the BBC, Google has confirmed that it will remove the music videos of independent artists unless they sign up to its upcoming subscription music service. Many independent musicians and labels have refused to do so, claiming that the contracts offer significantly worse deals than the likes of Spotify and Pandora, and that Google is unwilling to negotiate on the rates it offers artists. A Google spokesperson indicated that the company could start removing videos within days. So apparently, you know, if I wanted to start a band, I could just record the song, record a video of some kind, post it to YouTube, and start getting listeners and followers of my group. And apparently Google doesn't like this.
Well, I mean, at this point, if you want to listen to free music, I mean, YouTube is a great place to do it because you just, you know, you don't have to really pay attention to the video. And a lot of them are just
somebody post cover.
Right. Somebody posts an album cover.
Exactly.
And, yeah. So
are those legal?
Yeah, probably not.
No, right.
They're not. So, you know, I think that is one thing that Google needs to do is get a little better hold on that, and not that I'm the person who's going to sit here and join up with the independent artist movement or the artist movement of anything, but
right.
They probably do need to get a little better hold on that, and they're going to get in trouble for that if they don't, probably. A BGR article about Apple here, they will incorporate Touch ID fingerprint sensors into a variety of new devices this year, including new iPhone 6 models, the second-generation iPad Air or iPad 6, and the third generation iPad Mini, a new report from China indicates. So this is a report where they're, you know, they all this stuff gets created over there, and they get shipments of stuff in, and they think, okay, you know, here's what's going to happen. This the China Times has learned that Apple will significantly increase Touch ID orders this year, with shipments expected to hit 120 million units, which is a 233% increase compared to the same period last year. Additionally, the new Touch ID modules will be even more durable than their predecessors, the report says. The fingerprint sensor will be even more important for Apple's future plans, as the company announced at WWDC just a few weeks ago that developers will have access to the Touch ID functionality, which could be added to a variety of apps that require stronger security, especially finance-related ones. More importantly, the fingerprint scanner may one day be used for Apple's rumored mobile payment plans that have been detailed in some reports and even in existing Apple patents. Now, a recent leak, which reportedly shows the Apple iPhone 6, iPad Mini 3, and iPad Air 2, reveals that all these upcoming 2014 iOS devices will incorporate a Touch ID home button. So right now, the only thing that has a Touch ID is the 5S and the 5C. Does the 5C have it? I don't remember.
I think it does.
I don't remember. I'll look that up while we're going to the next article. But so you put your thumb on the Touch ID, which is essentially the home button,
mm-hmm.
And then it will unlock your phone because it reads your thumbprint. And I think they only have two things available for Touch ID right now. Number one is unlock it, and number two is sign into the Apple Store. I think that's the only two that you can do with it right now.
Right, and signing in the Apple Store would also include making your second purchase after putting your password on iTunes or the App Store, from what I understand anyway. So, you know, everyone had to see this coming. You know, comes on your phone, it'd have to come on the next touch device you use. I wonder when they're going to put it on their computers.
That's a good question. I mean, will they put it on their computers? And no, it is not on the 5C, by the way.
Really?
It's only on the 5S.
I have learned
something. So, according to what I'm seeing here, and I kind of thought that was the case, but so the iPhone 5S has the Touch ID. Will they put it on their computers? I mean, who knows? I mean, you know, would it be difficult to put something there, maybe around where the mouse or where the trackpad is, the touchpad is already, where you could just stick your finger down there and, you know, right there and let it scan your finger and unlock your computer.
Add a home button to my...
Yeah, home button on your computer.
That's interesting. I will have to think about that one. This is pretty cool. Cryptocurrency, or I guess digital currency, whatever you want to call it. Apparently, Bitcoin's future was looking a little murky, but Expedia is going to start accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment. First, they will accept it for hotel bookings only, and will accept it only in USA, and also will not be holding Bitcoins for any length of time, converting it to dollars as soon as they can. But, quoting Emily Spavin, a managing editor of Bitcoin news site CoinDesk, has told the BBC, "The move was brilliant news, and it brings digital currency further into the consciousness of the mainstream." You can't quite fly to Galt's Gulch on your newly Bitcoin-purchased real estate without switching currencies, but I guess this is a good step if you're if you think digital currency is a good step. But
and we talked, and while you were at VBS last week, we talked a lot about Bitcoin, and Bitcoin today is rated at $584.05 per Bitcoin. So if you want to buy one Bitcoin, it's $584.05, and it's up a little bit today, about 0.2%. But it has dropped off, and what they were saying there in that article is, you know, Bitcoin's been having some problems. It started having problems back at the front of the year, or earlier in the year, when it got up real high, and then they had some security breaches, and a bunch of them got stolen, and then it dropped way down, and then it kind of started to rise back up sort of in the front of May there, and it's kind of fallen back down again, and the government just finished making some big sales of Bitcoins that they'd gotten from that they had essentially taken from,
like seized.
Seized. That's a better word. And we talked about that some last week. So yeah, Bitcoin is it's interesting. I mean, it's volatile. It's extremely volatile, and it's not a backed currency. And I just think it's interesting to see people embrace it and bring it on. I don't know how far it's going to go.
I've heard of people on Reddit that a guy lost his entire life savings because he had invested like $40,000 or some other into it, and he lost it all. And his wife says, "Stop it! He's already about to take out a loan, invest more." Some people, I don't know.
You have to be careful when you do investments, for sure. A Uber Gizmo article, not a site that I usually grab articles from, but I thought this was just it's kind of tech, I guess. It was kind of cool. The article starts off by saying, "We often come across viral content on the internet that restores our faith in humanity. The reason why such content gets quite popular online in the first place is because it makes other people feel good about the world, regardless of how much negativity is spewed out there every day. The most recent example of this is truly heartwarming. A little girl named Katie, who wanted to spend time with her dad on his birthday, wrote a letter to his employer, who just so happened to be Google, asking if he could have a day off to celebrate his birthday. Now, Google responded perfectly. The letter had been circulating on the internet the past few days, and now it's gathered quite a lot of steam. Dear Google worker, this little girl wrote, can you please make sure when Daddy goes to work, he gets one day off. Liv, he can get a day off on Wednesday because Daddy only gets a day off on Saturday." And that was a quote from her letter. Now, you might think she couldn't possibly be more cute, but at the end, she put, "P.S., it's Daddy's birthday." And then she writes again, "P.P.S., it's summer, you know." So Google actually writes her a letter back and responded and said, quote, "Thank you for your thoughtful note and request." And it went on to read there in the rest of the letter, "Your father has been hard working designing many beautiful and delightful things for Google and millions of people across the globe. On the occasion of his birthday and recognizing the importance of taking some Wednesdays off during the summer, we are giving him the whole first week of July as vacation time." Oh. And that was written by Daniel Shipskoloff. I think it's one of their one of their executives. But and they did confirm, Google did confirm it was authentic. And so not really a lot of tech news there, but I thought it was kind of cool that you know, it's important that a big business still care about their employees. And sounds like Google's doing okay with that.
Google's pretty cool. I mean, have you ever looked at some of their perks? I mean, they've got like gourmet kitchens in like every, I guess it's building. Basically, if you want lunch, you just go down to have a gourmet chef cook you something. You know, you can bring dogs to work regularly. I think they regularly have, I don't know, they'll have activities like sports and stuff against, you know, other departments and things. I just think that's really cool. And they even have, like, a bus service for people, you know, to the Googleplex. But, and usually we only have 10 articles, but I had to add this one. This is probably my favorite. As a former diehard BlackBerry user, it makes me feel good to hear that RIM, or Research in Motion, which is the people that own and run BlackBerry, they're back in profit. They,
RIM's back in profit?
RIM is back in profit.
What are they doing now? Selling hamburgers or something?
There must be. But an anonymous reader sends word that BlackBerry hit hard over the past several years by the emergence of smartphones, such as the iPhone, which is probably the thing that killed it, has come back to profitability. BlackBerry has been fighting an uphill battle to stay relevant in the world of mobile devices and has lost market share to Apple, companies like Samsung that offer gadgets running on Google's Android operating system, and even Microsoft. You can say that because they have more share than BlackBerry, I believe, or in more market share. But John Chen, who took over as CEO in November, has injected new life to the company after laying off tons and tons of people, I'm sure. Let's see here. Chen, who says BlackBerry is getting close to breaking even on its hardware business, has steered the company's focus towards more software. He's made several product announcements that Wall Street has cheered. Last month, the company launched its project Ion, an initiative to develop more connected devices, a trend dubbed the Internet of Things. How many more times are we going to say that? On Wednesday, BlackBerry reached a deal with Amazon that will let users of BlackBerry's newest operating system access Android apps in Amazon's App Store later this fall. That's interesting. Good for them.
Yay, BlackBerry.
Good for them.
Way to go, RIM. We're happy that you're back in the black, finally, after years and years of not being there.
Hey, I will say this for dedicated keyboards. On my BlackBerry, I think I had a 9700 bold. Not that it really matters now. They're almost dead. I could type faster on that, text faster than I could on my any touchscreen device I've ever had, my iPhone included. So, I mean, yay for them, I guess.
I never had the opportunity or privilege of having a RIM device. So I guess you'll just have to tell me.
I still have a couple if you want to try it on. They still power on, too. Hey, the battery was amazing. I mean, you'd last for like 3 days. All right. Shall we move on?
We shall move on. So last week, I mentioned that we were hoping to have Mr. Eddie Wilson with Christian Ministries International with us, and just got off the horn with him before the show, and he was traveling today and got kind of behind on the flight schedule and just got off the plane, so he's not going to be able to be with us this week, but we hope to have him back hope to have him with us soon. So with that being said, I think we're going to transition into App of the Week.
So, our app of the week is actually Microsoft Security Essentials. So, let's see here. I honestly probably use this every day, and a lot of people probably use it, don't even realize it. Microsoft Security Essentials can be used to help guard against viruses, spyware, and other malicious software. It provides real-time protection for your home or small business PCs. Microsoft Security Essentials is free, and it was designed to be simple to install and easy to use. It runs quietly and efficiently in the background, so you don't have to worry about interruptions or making updates.
Usually, this is a disclaimer. Usually when an antivirus... Okay, first of all, there's no perfect antivirus, but when an antivirus company tells you... Well, when an antivirus program tells you that it runs quietly and efficiently in the background, so you don't have to worry about interruptions or making updates... Usually that's a bunch of hooey.
Of course.
But I will say that I've used Microsoft Security Essentials at home and that for my use, I've noticed that it does exactly that. It scans in the background. It doesn't seem to bog down the computer, and I don't know whether it's just where it's so integrated with the operating system, but it doesn't seem to bog down the operating system. And... you know, it'll tell you if you have an alert of a virus or something like that, or malware or spyware. It does catch those a lot of times as well, but that's about the only time you get alerted from it. It updates itself. It updates itself with, you know, daily and also through automatic updates. And, you know, if you have a Windows machine and you don't have an antivirus program, or if you have a Windows machine and you're getting bombarded by some other antivirus program that wants you to purchase it, then I would really highly suggest taking a look at Microsoft Security Essentials, windows.microsoft.com/security essentials, I believe. But you can just do a search on the web for MSE. Microsoft, for MSE, yep, or Microsoft Security Essentials. And Kurt, you've used it a lot too, right?
Yeah, and I really don't want to just, you know, put down other antiviruses, but I've never seen one that's this out of the way. You know, there's some where the settings are a little too high, and every link you click on, something will pop up and say, do you want to run this script, or do you want to do this? Something was detected on this website. There'll be toolbars installed along with it. I know AVG has a toolbar. I used to swear by AVG. I thought AVG was the greatest. But now, as of late, it seems to be bogging things down too, and MSE really doesn't seem to do that. It really gets out of the way, and it's very, very simple. As soon as you install it, you see a little icon, looks like a castle or house in the bottom right corner. If it's green, it's good. If it's orange, it needs to update or run a scan. And if it's red, it's found something. That's pretty much it.
It's pretty straightforward. So, yeah. And once again, you know, we're not endorsing these products as in they paying us for it, but we these are products that Kurt and I have used, and we really like them. So check it out if you don't have any antivirus, or maybe you're paying for antivirus and you want to stop paying for it. Microsoft Security Essentials. And so with that, we're going to move into the deep dive. All right, so for our deep dive today, we're going to take a look at a few articles, as we do, and talk about them and discuss them a little more in depth. The Verge this week had an article out about Amazon Fire. It's the new phone from Amazon. Amazon has unveiled this new Fire phone, and it's a modified version of Android, which is a Google operating system freeware. And it will launch exclusively for AT&T's network. And the screen is a 4.7-inch IPS LCD screen that they tested. They tested 4.3 and 5.5, but they decided to use 4.7. And it has an emphasis on brightness. It runs on a quad-core. Remember, we were talking about cores earlier. It runs on a quad-core 2.2 gigahertz processor with 2 gigs of RAM and an Adreno 330 graphics processor unit. It has a rear-facing 13-megapixel camera with five-element lens with image stabilization, and there's a dedicated physical button at the side of the phone that will turn it on and put it into camera mode when pressed. The phone comes with dual stereo speakers that produce a virtual surround sound, and Amazon wants the phone to be distinctive for its ability to provide video content both from a hardware and software perspective. So, Kurt, how much have you seen, you know, about this phone so far? What's your thoughts on it?
Well, the first thing I thought when I first saw it was, why Amazon? Why would anybody want to, you know, jump into this? What on earth does Amazon have to do in this? But I remember few years back when I heard Google was buying basically the infrastructure required for them to get phones, and everyone's like, why Google? But look at them now. I mean, they've got operating system that's more used, the phone operating system that's more used than any other. I mean, of course, yes, it is fragmented to many, many, many different types, you know, but why Amazon? I'm sure something can come up, but we're all seeing Apple and Google, you know, they have these app stores, these stores for applications, and, you know, they're having other people write the code for free, and they will take a slice off of what everybody pays to get into it. That's honestly the way to do it. They're not even doing the work of writing the apps and stuff for it, so I can see where they would want to jump into that, and sooner or later it would turn a profit for them. But in terms of the phone itself, it looks pretty good, I guess. I mean, I've not used, I've obviously, you know, we've not actually held one in our hands, but
yeah, I mean, I watched some videos of the guys, you know, of a guy using it, and it, you know, it looks like a phone. and it has six cameras. So the big difference about the Amazon Fire Phone is that it does spatial recognition. So if you turn the phone, as you turn the phone, and Apple did this a little bit with iOS 7. But
Samsung, I think they actually marketed this. They said, you know, this is something your phone is good for. They had commercials where a guy would look at his phone, and he'd kind of look down, and the content on the screen would start scrolling, or he would look up and it would scroll the other way. So, you know, there's some, actually, a group is actually marketed to this. So I guess Amazon's taking this to the nth degree with, you know, the spatial movements.
Right, and that's exactly right. So I mean, those four cameras in the front of the phone essentially track the head, and as your head moves, or as you move the phone and it sees things move around it, then it, you know, repositions the screen in almost like a 3D type environment. Is that cool to me? I mean, granted, I haven't touched the phone or used it, but you know, off the top of my head, I would say no, not really. But I don't know. I mean, maybe I would get used to that and start to move it. But I watched a video on The Verge, and I'll try to put the video out on our Facebook page later. But it had a lot of features, like, you know, you could flick it to the right and flick it to the left and do different things like that. I feel strange enough when I shake my phone, my iPhone, to do undo. That just seems really strange to me to do. I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I start shaking my phone, and everybody's looking at you like, "What are you doing?" And you know, you have one of these things, and you're walking down the road, and you're all of a sudden looking like you're trying to cast your phone out into the cast your phone out into the lake and reel back in
fishing
a fish
for
or something.
Text messages.
Exactly. So I mean, I don't know. I mean,
I have an Xbox 360. I wanted to get the Kinect because of the new way of gameplay. Mm-hmm. Now what I realize I use the Kinect the most for is the, you know, you can interact with the menus, and even, you know, just, you know, by stand up, you wave at it for a second, it catches you, and then you can interact with the menus. I think that it's actually really cool. You know, you can be on a Netflix video, wave your hand a certain way, you catch it, and you can grab the slider and move it along. It feels really cool. I know we'd mentioned this before with the movie Minority Report, mm-hmm. where he has these screens floating ahead of him, and he, you know, moves and swipes and stretches and moves them all different ways. You know, is that the future? Is that the way we're going to be heading with spatial recognition? I don't know what else to call this, really. But, right. I mean, it's, when I use it on the Kinect, it's very cool. Sometimes it's a little clunky every so often, especially when you select something. You hold your hand and you kind of hold it there for a second, and you'll see a little palm appear, and it'll start counting real quick. It takes, what, like a second and a half? Because, you know, you pull it away if you didn't want to select that. You know, is that the future? Is there something that we're already too old to appreciate and see? I'm sure somebody will get it, and somebody will think, hey, I got to have this once the early adopters grab it. But, you know, is this where we're going? And just Amazon's the first one to put it in a phone?
I mean, I think we're seeing, and I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think we're seeing a lot more of companies who make devices looking at how do I incorporate the user's body to be the rest of the user's body, especially their face and their eyes, to be a tool to make the phone function the input way they want it to, an input tool.
Right.
You know, used to the input tool, the only input tool you had was a keyboard, you know, and then the mouse come along. And now, you know, we're to the point where input is, you know, the way I look with my eye, like with Google Glass. I mean, you look a certain way with your eye.
Take a picture.
Exactly. So right. Amazon Fire phone here is doing the same thing. You know, the way that you turn your head or the way you move the phone will scroll up and down. And the way that, you know, the way you turn it will change the spatial recognition of how you see things on the screen, almost like they called it peeking around the corner. You like in games, they could use it to, you know, you could turn your phone and actually kind of peek around the corner in a game, which, again, I'm not the gamer. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me, but it's interesting.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I know where people are trying to – there's a Kinect SDK out there, a developer kit, where they can you know, you can basically use it to interact with your computer however you want to. And I saw a demo where some Microsoft group had in their, I think, free time developed where you could create a database using Kinect. I can't remember, like, he threw his hand out to grab it, and it created a new one. And then it was add columns or add a table was another motion. And then to add add fields to that table was something else. And then he'd like to get rid of it. He just like threw every limb at it or something. It was really interesting. It's kind of useless because, I mean, what, if my boss going to come by my office if I was a database developer, database designer, and he sees me waving my hands around the air, he's not going to think I'm working. But, I don't, I mean, it's got to be the... I don't want to say it's got to be the future, but, you know, there's got to be a market for it, for them to do that. It may be really small at first, but I guess sooner or later it's going to be how people interact with things. I personally don't see it, and I'm probably too set in my ways to change how I do things. But
well, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, the phone needs to be ease of use.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's really where it needs to be. I mean, if the phone is easy to use, then people will start to buy it and use it. And if it's not, then it'll just kind of go by the wayside. And obviously, Amazon's looking for a way to put another piece of equipment in people's hands
to get money
and also not to get money just from the phone, but to get money because everything on the Amazon Fire phone is integrated back to Amazon, and you know, you purchase things on Amazon, you purchase things on Prime, et cetera.
Did you see though how they demonstrated Firefly software that recognizes physical objects using the phone's camera?
So, yeah, talk a little bit about that, Kurt.
Let's see here. I'm just going to read from this. It says and it will recognize physical objects as well as TV shows and songs it hears. So it says it runs quickly, often identifying things in less than a second, and it pulls up an Amazon product listing, of course.
You can buy it.
It can even recognize art. Firefly has its own dedicated physical button on the phone, and Amazon is providing a Firefly SDK to third parties who want to develop with it.
So in the video that I watched, and I forgot about that part, but in the video where I watched, the guy had he had several different items, but like he had a CD cover. He had a CD, you know, like a CD case, and he threw it out there on the table and stuck the phone up, the back camera of the phone up towards it, and the phone popped up and told him the label of the CD. He swiped up, and he had a whole bunch of options of what he could do. He could buy specific tracks. He could buy the album. He could buy whatever.
That's pretty cool.
And then he was in some sort of store, and there was like lemon drops or something there on the.
He just pointed
at the label, and it popped up. You know where you could order it. I'm sure from Amazon or wherever. And so you know that's kind of cool, I guess. So if you wanted to know what something was, or you wanted to easily purchase something, or you wanted to check all the prices on something,
now that's not new technology. Now
no.
Google has done that at least. I don't know what the service is actually called, but you could point it at a book, specifically even the ISBN ISBN code, and it will, you know, it'll show you the product, and then from there Google lets you search further. You know, if you want to go to products or. Google Shopping. That's not anything that new. And when you think about it, that's not that impressive from Google because they've already, you know, archived everything being
right.
Google. So now it is impressive that they have streamlined it this much. Of course, you know, Amazon's going to throw in their ability to get money from it. But I don't know. I'm sure everything will have a look at everything app. You know, what is this?
Well, if any of our listeners have, you know, started to look at the Amazon Fire, or maybe you've, you know, maybe you're looking at purchasing one pretty quickly, you know, shoot us an email, wccrtechtalk@gmail.com, or post something to our Facebook page, WCCR Tech Talk on Facebook, and let us know how you like it. Let us know about your Amazon Fire phone and what your thoughts are on it. And you know, if we get any responses on that, we'll come back to it and see what our users think about it, because that's the most important part. A Network World article, we'll move on here, about pretty much the government versus the internet. ICANN is trying to get new generic top-level domains out there. Let me read the article here. More than 3,300 representatives from around the world have descended on London to discuss what will happen after the U.S. turns over control of the world's central DNS servers to ICANN, or the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Now, let's explain this for a second. So
What does DNS do?
Okay. We've talked about this, I think, in episode one or two, but DNS essentially means domain name service, and it translates...
I'm going to go to google.com.
And it translates that into an IP address, and that IP address is actually the address that takes you to the server. So it would be like me telling you, I live in Justin's house, but you need to translate that into an address to get to my house. So that's what DNS does. Now, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers are going to take over these are going to take over the control of the central DNS servers. Now, during the Monday morning keynote at this conference, this world conference, Ed Vasily, UK Minister for Culture, and I'm sure I butchered his last name, I'm sorry, Ed, Communications and Creative Industries, said that great faith in the internet community as the U.S. takes... or says he had great faith in the internet community as the U.S. takes a step back from its governance role. Success in preparing the way for ICANN to take over will occur only through a collaborative bottom-up approach rather than through state-centered regulation, according to Mr. Ed there. So ICANN is trying to get this new generic top-level domain out there, but governments are getting, you know, kind of governments are getting kind of pushy about this. You know, they want control. ICANN is trying to put out these new top-level domains as well. So what I mean by that is .com, .net, .org, .edu. Those are top-level domains. But I don't know how much you've heard about this, but they're putting out new ones like .wine, W-I-N-E. You know, different just nouns that are top level domain names now, and there's certain countries like France, for instance, they're getting upset about the .wine one, and I'm not really sure why. But the question is, how much control should these governments around the world have over the internet, and who owns the internet? I mean, those are questions. I mean, you know. Technically, you know, the United States takes care of these domain services, and they also take care of, you know, distributing, for the most part, IP addresses to the world. So if you think of it in that way, the United States seems to own the internet because right. Whoever owns the naming system and whoever owns the IP addresses is who actually owns the internet.
You can't get there, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you could turn it off. So... what's your thoughts, Kurt? I mean, how much control should the governments have over this? I mean, what do you think?
Well, I'd like to start off with, you know, who invented it?
Al Gore, right?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, of course it was Al Gore. Everyone should look that up, by the way. It's kind of interesting how that came about. But I don't know. I mean, I don't want to say we as in America, but, I mean, that started as an ARPA. I believe thing, which later became DARPA, but you know, it started, I guess the first two network computers was what in Hawaii, and then, you know, from some school, and then I think another school, I really don't know the name specifically, they developed it into a network, and then slowly from, I guess, the late 80s, early 90s, it, you know, became the internet as we know today, where mm-hmm. I get to a computer, I get content, if that's in a central location. And that's where we came up with not having the foresight to have IP addresses that number in the trillions instead of having ones that number in the millions. Millions? Anyway, so, you know, I guess nobody really assumed that it would become global. And so, you know, America started with it, or the United States started with it and made it global. And then... I guess they should relinquish control to, a group since everyone uses it. It's an integral, you know, I don't know how many companies, it's probably integral to their, you know, daily running, but.
It's going to be interesting to see how this kind of all plays out. I mean, you know, with the internet being the way it is and ICANN looking at doing these top-level domain name changes, I mean, in the past, the way that you did this type of thing was by buying up a country who didn't want their top-level domain name. So, for instance, if you go to, you know, if you go to a, you said you had a list.
Yeah, let's see. I'm trying to find one. Germany, Deutschland. There
is DE, right?
DE.
So
there's one for East Germany though. DD.
So if you go to a .de or a .dd site, So something dot something dot, you know, www.something.de, then that's a German site. More than likely, their domain name registration comes out of Germany. So, you know, there were small countries out there who didn't have enough traffic to need their own domain names, so companies would buy those up.
Right.
And that was all part of ICANN, which was being controlled by, you know, essentially by the U.S. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see what's going to happen after the U.S. turns over control of these central DNS servers or these top-level services that, if they are not done correctly and not organized correctly, will take down the internet.
Right. That's true.
To ICANN. And it'll be interesting to see how things work out for them.
Now, other top level that people probably used is like .gov, .mil for military, probably not used as much by most of our listeners.
Those were the first ones.
Right, the very first ones. The original, what, 7, I think it was. But, I mean, I'm on Wikipedia. There's a huge list. It's basically just listing
it's countries. All the countries, yeah. But now the top, the first ones were .mil, .gov, .com, .net, probably .org.
Yeah. Oh.
And .edu was for educational institutions.
.int, international organizations.
Okay.
Strictly limited organizations, offices, and programs which are endorsed by a treaty between two or more nations. Though, however, there are a few grandfather domain names that do not meet this criteria. Interesting. So, yeah, com, org, net, int, edu, gov, mil.
So. Okay, so those 7. So I had most of them there.
N is
one that's not – INT is one that's not as popular.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot of those left around. Obviously, everybody knows about .com. And, you know, there's a lot of .orgs and a lot of .nets, not as many .nets. And obviously, educational institutions are .edu.
Right.
But so in the future, you know, now, if I was to go out and say, okay, I want a website, typically most people think, okay, I'm going to do a website, www.justinhensley.com. But now and moving forward, you're going to be able to get a website like, you know, maybe I want to sell.
Look at the list. I see clothing.
Yeah.
I see builders, Arrow Academy.
Right. And so, I mean, if there is a word that associates with your company, like school, dot school, you know, or if I want to sell, you know, computers. Dot computer, you know, there's going to be all the name at the end is going to be infinite now, and so it'll be interesting to see how you know, there's going to be a lot of money in that. There's going to be a lot of confusion, in my opinion, in that. I mean, it's hard enough to get people to figure out what is in that middle part, www.whatever.com,
right?
But I mean, go to my website, www.justinhensley.computers.something.blah.
Hilarious.
You know, I don't know. But it's money. It's getting money. And two, it's running out of names. I mean, you can only have so many names. You know, nobody wants a 100-character website name. You want to try to keep it as concise as possible, and those are running out.
There's a dot plumbing.
Dot plumbing.
But these are one that I guess have been already proposed with dot plumbing, dot glass, window selling business. Yeah. Dot email. That's interesting.
So
dot domains.
Dot domains. Exactly. So there's all kinds of them out there, and it's going to be interesting. I mean, in the next few years, you're not going to go out to websites the same way that you have before. It's not going to be jcpenney.com. It's going to be jcpenney.clothing. You know, it'll be different. So it'll be interesting to see how that runs out. One more article for our deep dive today, and we'll take a look at this quickly here and then get ready to wrap up our show. We've still got a few minutes here. A CNET article on cloud storage. Microsoft said Monday that it plans to more than double the free storage it offers on OneDrive cloud storage. Microsoft also is raising the storage limits that come with its various Office 365 subscriptions. Now, these changes are going to go into effect in July. And the highlights for these changes are free storage climbs to 15 gigabytes from 7 gigabytes. Ooh. So it's going up by 8 gigs of storage.
Wow.
More than double.
More than double.
All Office 365 users now get 1 terabyte of storage, up from the previous 20 gig allocation. So 20 gigs to 1 terabyte, that's
huge.
20 gigs to...
That's more that's than an order of magnitude.
Right. So that's 20 gigs to 1,000 gigs. Okay? That's a terabyte. Office 365 personal subscribers get a terabyte of storage for $6.99 a month. In the UK, it's £5.99. however they say that. And Office 365 home subscribers get individual storage of 1 terabyte for up to 5 people for $10 a month, or $8 a month in the UK. I'm sorry, £8 a month in the UK. Microsoft also is reducing monthly storage subscription fees for users who don't want Office to $2 for 100 gigs, or $2 for 100 gigs per month, I think, from the $7.49 per month price. So, and it's dropping its price on the 200 gigs from $3.99 from $11.49. So, if you don't want an Office 365 subscription with Office, and for those of you who don't know what Office 365 is, Microsoft provides the ability to have a online version of Microsoft Office that you purchase and pay for in a monthly subscription. Well, if you don't want Word and Excel and all those other things, you can just get the storage. 100 gigs for $2 a month. I mean, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the pricing updates will take effect in the next month, and current subscribers will automatically be moved to new prices, Microsoft said this week. I mean, Kurt, how much bigger can it get? Well, I mean, this is pretty cool. I mean, if you need to store something, this is pretty cheap.
That's pretty good. I mean, I'll go ahead and say I've been using... See, I've had a Hotmail account since I was, I don't know how old, but...
5 and a half.
Maybe a little bit older than that, but
six. Okay.
But I've had a Hotmail account for quite a while, and for some reason, when it was originally called SkyDrive, when that came out, I got a SkyDrive account, and I started with 7 gigs, and somehow I was eligible for an upgrade, and automatically have 25 gigs free. No idea how.
Wow.
So from there, I mean, I like OneDrive. No, it's now called OneDrive, not SkyDrive anymore. I like using OneDrive. I mean, you can automatically sync whatever you want to. I know, at least on my work machine, there's occasionally a document that doesn't have any personal information on it that I can share, but I can only share that one if I want to. I don't have to share every single thing because I don't want personal pictures showing up on my work machine. But any device I have that has Windows 8 or 8.1 on it, I can set it to where it automatically syncs all that stuff. If I get a new device, I just put in my my Live account and Microsoft account, and it will automatically show me all the apps I have, and I can click to download them on that device if I want to. It's pretty cool. And also integration with my Xbox. If I had an Xbox One, you could automatically share videos of little quick highlights, I think up to 30 minutes. 30 minutes? Or is it 30 seconds? That's a pretty big difference. But you can do clips and highlights of your playtime and just share with people. And it does it automatically through OneDrive if you wanted to.
Hmm.
I think there's also integration with Facebook from OneDrive. And Office itself has very tightly integrated with OneDrive. So there's a lot of little benefits to this, and they must be really pushing to make this somewhere they want people to go.
Well, the cloud is a big thing, and don't let when people talk about the cloud, don't let the term scare you. It's essentially all it is just you're storing
FTP.
Yeah, you're storing things on a server that's somewhere else. So that's, when people come up to you and say, what do you think about the cloud? The cloud's great. I mean, you get to store...
Cumulonimbus.
Exactly.
Thunderhead.
You get to store stuff instead of having to store it on your computer and take up your hard drive space that sometimes you don't have a whole lot of. You get to store it sometimes for free, sometimes for a small price on someone else's server that has a lot of storage space. So, I mean, the cloud is good. And I think this is a nice move by Microsoft. They're going to have to do this type of thing to keep up. In order to get people to continue to use Microsoft Office and to use their product suites, they're going to have to offer things like this in order to keep people around and to provide that storage to them. And it's just mind-boggling to me. Can you imagine how many people are Office 365 subscribers? I mean, I should have looked up the numbers before the show, and I didn't. And they're giving all these people, starting next month, they're going to give them, what did I say? It was 15 gigabytes of free storage for all those users. Ooh. And I'm sorry, Office 365 users now get a terabyte of storage. So every one of those users gets a terabyte of storage, up to a terabyte of storage. I mean, that's just unbelievable.
That is crazy.
I mean, you know, I mean, and storage is getting cheaper, which is great for them. And when you talk about storing people's documents, you don't have to have fast retrieval. So you're not talking about this really super
streaming
speedy.
Yeah, I mean,
you're just talking about pulling a document off. Exactly. So, but still, though, the amount of storage that's going to be is just amazing to me. I mean, they're going to have complete data center facilities that are just designed for storage.
I think this will probably could help them in their tablets because, you know, what the lowest end Surface RT has 32 gig hard drive, and a bunch of that is taken up by the operating system itself. So there's not a lot of space to store a lot of things, and that was, I think, by design, so that you would be forced to use more of the cloud because, you know, you get 7 gigs free. And this is probably going to help with the barriers of some people saying, you know, oh, I have to get 64 gig because it's bigger. So, well, in this case, since you've got all the storage that's really cheap out there, you know, that's probably going to help some people make a decision to switch to a Surface, even the smaller one, the cheaper one, because you got all the storage out there for free.
You don't have to store it locally.
I mean, that's
essentially what this is. It's like we're talking about the cloud. You don't have to store it locally anymore. You can store it in the cloud. And, you know, does that have risks? Sure, it has risks, especially if the service goes down.
I mean, even games. You know, every game I put in my Xbox will pop up and say, do you want to go to the local hard drive? Or it even has a cloud. You can pick one. Is that way your saves are out there? I've heard of numerous people saying, well, my hard drive died on my whatever device they're using, Xbox, PlayStation, and lost all my saves. You know, that can now be stored out there in the cloud.
Yep.
Make it somebody else's problem.
Make them back it up. Well, that does it for our deep dive today, and we've got one more section of our show, and we're going to have Tech in Numbers. So in today's technology numbers market, technology was down by about 0.5% today, so we get to put our sad face on. But we do have some good news. There was a major gainer today. Sina Corp, S-I-N-A Corp, out of China, gained about a little over 1.5 points today, 3.6% increase. They are a online media company serving China and the global Chinese communities. They have the sites sina.com, sina.cn, and weibo.com. And they enable internet users to access professional media and user-generated content. Now, our loser for today was Web.com Group. They lost a little over 6 points today for a 17% loss. And they are a small to medium-sized provider of internet services for small to medium-sized businesses. And that does it today for Tech in Numbers. All right. Well, that concludes our show, episode number 5. We appreciate you listening to us today. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook, www.facebook.com/WCCRTechTalk, on Twitter at WCCRTechTalk, and also you can email us, WCCRTechTalk@gmail.com. Don't forget to go out to our Facebook page or search for us on iTunes Tech Talk today to listen to our podcast. It'll be out later tonight.
All right, then. And be sure to stay on for the next couple hours for the Figure 4 Fallout with Russell Reitner, Bo Kidd, Casey Malone, Dustin Harden, and Justin Durbin. That'll be 7 to 9. And you are listening to WCCR 94.5 LPFM. Thank you very much for listening. We're going to leave you with just one quick song, at least, between here and then. Let's go with White Stripes.